This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Worldwide, the number of confirmed coronavirus cases has surpassed 4 million. The global death tally is over 280,000, according to Johns Hopkins University statistics. The World Health Organization has dismissed as false allegations a media report that it withheld information about the new coronavirus following pressure from China. The UN agency said in a statement that a German magazine's report about a phone call between the WHO's chief and the Chinese president in January was unfounded and untrue. Der Spiegel reported that the Chinese president asked the WHO chief during the call to hold back information about human-to-human transmission of the virus and delay declaring a pandemic. The UN agency says the call simply never happened. U.S. President Donald Trump has been among the strongest critics of the WHO's handling of the pandemic, accusing it of deference to China and ceasing payments to the agency. Italy has registered its lowest total of daily new COVID-19 cases since the start of the nationwide lockdown in early March. According to health ministry data, 802 coronavirus infections were confirmed in the 24-hour period ending Sunday evening. That's also the first time daily new cases have dropped below the 1,000 mark since very early in the country's outbreak. Italy now totals over 219,000 cases. In Greece, there were no deaths from COVID-19 and only six new cases over the past 24 hours, Greek authorities announced Sunday. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in the country is now over 2,700. On Monday, most retail shops will open and high school seniors will return to school. This is VOA News. Three members of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, placed themselves in quarantine after contact with someone who tested positive for COVID-19. Another stark reminder that not even one of the nation's most secure buildings is immune from the virus. Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and a leading member of the task force, has become nationally known for his simple and direct explanations to the public about the coronavirus and COVID-19, the disease it causes. Also quarantining are Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, Stephen Hahn. Fauci's institute said that he has tested negative for COVID-19 and will continue to be tested regularly. It added that he is considered at relatively low risk based on the degree of his exposure and that he would be taking appropriate precautions to mitigate the risk to personal contacts while still carrying out his duties. While he will stay at home and telework, Fauci will go to the White House if called and take every precaution, the institute said. The coronavirus pandemic is straining social safety nets across the globe and underlying sharp differences in approach between wealthy societies such as the United States and Europe. In Europe, the collapse in business activity is triggering wage support programs that are keeping millions on the job for now. In the United States, more than 33.5 million people have applied for jobless benefits, and the unemployment rate has soared to 14.7%. Congress has passed $2 trillion in emergency support, boosting jobless benefits and writing stimulus checks of up to $1,200 per taxpayer. That is a pattern seen in earlier economic downturns in the U.S., including the Great Recession. Europe depends on existing programs kicking in that pump money into people's pockets. Dozens of scientists are waiting in quarantine for the all clear to join a year-long Arctic research mission aimed at improving the models used for forecasting climate change. For a while, the international mission looked like it might have to be called off as country after country went into lockdown because of the virus, hampering plans to bring fresh supplies and crew to the German research vessel that's been moored in the high Arctic since last year. News of the pandemic caused jitters among those already on board, said Matthew Shoup, an atmospheric scientist and co-leader of the Mosaic expedition. Some people just wanted to be home with their families, he told the Associated Press in an interview from a German port where he and about 90 other scientists and crew have been in isolation to ensure they're virus-free. This is VOA News via remote.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
That the National Assembly should take custody of this fund and ensure that it is properly budgeted for in the interest of Nigerians, and that it should take care of the responsibilities of the states, the local government, and the federal government. That is simply the demand of the People's Democratic Party.
A major Nigerian opposition party demands transparency in the use of public funds.
Wherever you are in Sierra Leone, get on board. Help those who cannot afford to purchase masks. Help them by providing them with free masks. And there are quite a few organizations that I know of doing things across the country. But the more, the merrier. The more people who do this, the better it will be for all of us.
A Sierra Leonean NGO distributes masks to traders in the capital, Freetown.
Levy and companies and other countries have been contributing to the COVID-19 fund. And we are saying these are resources that could be channeled towards fighting COVID-19 and spare the salaries of public servants, which they need.
And Botswana public sector workers say the government is violating an agreement by postponing payment of salary increment. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria's opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, is calling for transparency and accountability in the disbursement of repatriated funds looted by former President Sani Abacha. The public funds were reportedly siphoned into offshore accounts by the former leader. The government has been working with its international partners to return the embezzled funds. The PDP says the government should document in detail how it is using the funds to help alleviate poverty in the West African country. This after opposition party leaders say they were unimpressed with the explanation of the government regarding use of the funds. Kola Ologbodiyang, spokesperson for the PDP, tells me the apparent lack of transparency in how the administration is using the funds undermines the president's fight to weed out graft.
The People's Democratic Party has demanded from the ruling government to provide explanation on how it expended the $322 million that was released to it in the past as repatriated fund from the money looted by the former military head of state, General Sani Abacha. It is strange for us in the People's Democratic Party that a sum of $322 million will be claimed to have been spent as money to the poorest of the poor in 19 states of the Federation, where the government claimed to have listed 300,000 households as beneficiaries of this humongous sum. Strangely, and very strange indeed, it has been discovered that the beneficiaries of these $322 million are phony family names which were just used to loot the resources. And we have challenged the government to come out and explain in clear details how it expended the money in the past.
Bakola Femi Adesina, a spokesman of the president, said that if the opposition PDP wants to find out what the monies were used for, you should look in the budget. It is clearly stipulated there. Why hasn't the PDP checked on that?
Mr. Femi Adesina, the presidential spokesman, is playing pranks by asking the People's Democratic Party to look into the budget for what the money in the past was spent on. What we have said is that the figure which the federal government received as repatriation from Abacha's loot in the past was $322 million. And this money was claimed to have been spent on the poorest of the poor by further claiming that about 300,000 households were allocated this fund. At the end of the day, Nigerians discovered that the list which the federal government paraded were phony names or people who are neither non-existent or are not even known in their areas of domain. And as such, the People's Democratic Party is saying that whatever is being paid or has been repatriated to Nigeria currently, particularly the $311 million, should be paid into the Federation account and should be budgeted for appropriately. That's the demand of the People's Democratic Party.
Kola, supporters of the ruling party are saying that the government has been transparent so far about how the monies were used to help the ordinary Nigerian, and that the PDP is just merely playing politics and playing mind games just to score cheap political points, even during this pandemic. Your response to that?
Such supporters of President Muhammadu Buhari or supporters of President Buhari's administration should go back to the allegation of by the First Lady Aisha Buhari, who alerted the nation that the APC's government's $500 billion social investment program is a huge scam and that the bulk of such funds was never spent on ordinary Nigerians. And in the past, there were dispositions from the government where certain amounts of money were paid to charge and bail lawyers in Nigeria as those who work out the release of this fund. The People's Democratic Party is worried. We are concerned about Nigerians. That why will a government who claim to be interested in the lives of the poor will be diverting funds that are meant to help the poor to interests that are working for their party? There lies our fears in the People's Democratic Party. And all we are asking for is that rather than coming to Nigeria to claim that the American government preconditioned the release of this money for certain projects, we are saying that the only law that guides our government and guides the people of Nigeria is the 1999 Constitution as amended. And it has provided that any money accruing to the government should be paid into the Federation account from where it will be budgeted for. And we are saying that the National Assembly should take custody of this fund and ensure that it is properly budgeted for in the interest of Nigerians, and that it should take care of the responsibilities of the states, the local government, and the federal government. That is simply the demand of the People's Democratic Party. And we have not made any demand outside what the Constitution provides for. And we are just asking this government of APC not to step aside the Constitution, not to abandon the Constitution, but to follow what the law provides for in line with democratic tenets all over the world.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The founder of Lunchbox Gift says her organization, in partnership with Madam Woki Fashion, have launched the distribution of 60,000 face masks to traders in the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown, Saturday. Maimuna Jani says she is working with health authorities to distribute the masks in a move to help stop the spread of the coronavirus in the West African country. She says the distribution of the masks will continue through Monday. Maimuna also tells me plans are underway to raise about $30,000 to expand the efforts to provide masks to prevent the spread of the virus.
We've started the distribution of masks to 60,000 traders on Saturday, and this distribution will continue until Monday. This is a climax, obviously, of a much larger campaign that seeks to help to control the spread of a disease by providing people in the public domain, low-income traders, with protection by wearing masks. So that's what we've done today. We started the distribution on Saturday, and that will continue until Monday.
Maimuna, what was the reaction of the traders you presented the masks to?
The traders were very excited to receive these gifts. Of course, the government has made it compulsory for people to wear masks. And if you imagine, for low-income people, this is an expense that they really can't generally afford. So they were absolutely ecstatic that we had actually come up with a project that had market traders in mind. And they were just really very grateful. We got such a lot of positive feedback from them. But also we got them trained on how to use masks, how to care for masks, how to wear masks. And this is information that really they had no knowledge of until we started this campaign. So they were very, very happy to receive the masks from us.
What's the next target after distributing approximately 60,000 masks to traders in Freetown? What's the next target?
Yes, we're working very closely with the EOC, which is the authority that the government has created to oversee and manage the response to the COVID pandemic. And their data tells us that the next hotspot is the area immediately outside the capital city, which is Western Area Rural. So we're working with the EOC to develop a strategy that will help us to expand this campaign to the Wardsea area ahead of, you know, any major breakout in the area. We want to be there and make sure that we take strong preventative measures to stop the spread before it gets as bad as it is in Freetown.
So talk to me about funding. How are you currently being funded after you initially received some promises and some seed money from Rudiger and some international organizations?
Yes, you're absolutely right. We got a very generous seeding from the Rudiger Foundation and also Friends of Rudiger, and as you say, with the European Union. The strategy beyond that is basically crowdfunding. We've gone the old-fashioned way. We've just used our online platforms and mobilized support from the general public, from Sierra Leoneans at home and abroad, from Friends of Sierra Leone, and the response has been very good. So we were able to turn this around very, very quickly. We got the pledges and the funds into our system, and we were able to take action. So we hope that we can leverage the same systems again to expand to the next hotspot in the country. That's our current strategy anyway.
So what is your message to the people of Sierra Leone outside the capital of Freetown in this fight against the spread of the coronavirus, by providing masks to the underprivileged or traders?
This is a fight that we have to all get involved with. This is something that affects all of us, and we have to protect ourselves and we have to protect the people around us. And we have to listen to the guidelines from the World Institute organizations like the WHO, and also listen to the guidelines from the government of Sierra Leone. The advice is very clear that face masks help to control the spread of the disease. It's not the only answer. There are other things that we have to do, but wearing face masks can have a significant impact on the spread of the disease. So I think my message is to please just get on board wherever you are in Sierra Leone, get on board, help those who cannot afford to purchase masks, help them by providing them with free masks. And there are quite a few organizations that I know of doing things across the country, but the more the merrier. The more people who do this, the better it will be for all of us.
Maimuna Jane is the founder of Lunchbox Gift, a Sierra Leonean NGO. She spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. In Botswana, public sector workers' unions say the government is using the ongoing state of emergency to violate an agreement it signed with the group. Botswana Land Board Local Authorities and Health Workers Union, or BLAHU, says it is unacceptable for the administration to use effort to stop the spread of the coronavirus as an excuse to postpone salary increment for public sector workers. Analysts, however, say it will be difficult for the workers' unions to use mass actions, including sit-down strikes, to pressure the government, especially during the ongoing state of emergency. Kate Halifile Motewa, Secretary General of the Botswana Land Board, Local Authorities and Health Workers Union, or BLAHU, tells me that members of the workers' union say they are regrettably disappointed the government is using the fight against the disease as an excuse to postpone their salary increase.
Our members have been seriously disturbed by this deferment of salary increment, because remember, the salary increment is a product of negotiations that culminated into a collective bargaining agreement. So therefore, it is not proper for the government to, at this stage, to be now renegading on this agreement. Remember, workers are hard hit by the economic challenges. They too need to fulfill certain financial obligations in terms of their welfare and livelihoods.
Are you therefore saying the government violated the agreement you had?
Yes, indeed. The government violated the agreement. Remember, the collective bargaining agreement is as equivalent as a contract. Therefore, since that we have an agreement, none of the parties can alter the agreement unilaterally or fail to fulfill the obligation. So in this instance, government unilaterally took a decision that they will not fulfill their obligations. So, and we are saying this is bad for industrial relations because government must uphold and respect the principles of good faith bargaining by way of subscribing to or fulfilling that which they have agreed with trade union. So failure to do that is bad for our industrial relations, which is already toxic by nature.
What recourse do you have to address this concern you have with what you said is the violation of the agreement by the government?
The recourse that we have right now is that we'll be approaching court. We have started a process of lodging the matter before court so that we litigate in an attempt to enforce the collective bargaining agreement so that government pays employees what is due to them. The challenge right now is that due to the issue of COVID-19, government has declared a state of emergency. And some of the provisions of the regulations are that there will be no, or rather, the right to strike has been taken away, which have weakened our bargaining powers, trade unions or employees. And then secondly, there is minimal activity in terms of our courts. So we are just waiting for the state of emergency to lapse, and then we'll continue the process of litigation. And at that particular time, some of the issues that will be seeking or making the prayers before court are that government will have to pay a 10% interest for withholding the salaries of employees, and issues of tax. Because what will happen is that some of the employees who are not taxable, by the time that they are paid lump sum arrears, that will then trigger them into taxable categories. So those are some of the detailed issues that we'll be dealing with.
What do you say to some people who are arguing that this is not the time to take the government to court or to challenge the government action, particularly when special measures are being implemented to prevent the spread of the disease, which is currently a pandemic affecting a lot of citizens?
No, we have stated before that trade unions understand that we have a COVID-19 pandemic, which the ILO says it's not only a medical issue, but it's also a socio-economic issue. So as patriotic citizens and organizations, we have been participating in the fight against COVID-19. Trade unions have contributed to the COVID-19 fund. Trade unions have been participating in terms of disseminating information on preventative measures to prevent the spread of the virus. Trade unions have been making recommendations to government with regard to economic and health measures for recovery and sustainability going forward. So we have been participatory and in this fight. So we are saying government needed to have been transparent enough to say this is the economic challenges we are facing now. For the next 6 years, this is how it's going to be. This is the strategy for fighting COVID-19, and this is the budget. And we were making options. We submitted options to government to say, we can look at our budget. Obviously, the developmental budget will not have spent much because there currently are no projects ongoing. So we'll make huge savings. So we are saying, let's reprioritize both the developmental budget and recurrent budget to deal with COVID-19 so that we spare the salaries of workers. And we also said there are other avenues such as the alcohol levy, the traffic fines levy, the human resource development council training levy, the disaster management fund levy, and companies and other countries have been contributing to the COVID-19 fund. And we are saying these are resources that could be channeled towards fighting COVID-19 and spare the salaries of public servants, which they need.
Ketlefile Motewa is the Secretary General of the Botswana Land Board Local Authorities and Health Workers Union, or BLAHU. He spoke with me from the capital, Habarone. In Malawi, the Catholic Commission for Justice and Peace has condemned politically related violence in parts of the country. The religious group says failure to resolve attacks, including the burning of cars and offices of political parties, are increasing tensions in the southern African country ahead of the upcoming July election. The group also warned that the current leadership of the Electoral Commission should not organize the presidential poll rerun. The remarks come after the Supreme Court upheld an earlier ruling of the Constitutional Court, which annulled the outcome of last year's presidential election. Luis Nkata is the head of the Justice and Peace Department of the Catholic Mission for Justice and Peace. He tells me that Malawians have lost faith in the ability of the leadership of the Electoral Commission to organize a free and transparent presidential poll.
This is because the Constitutional Court of Malawi and the Supreme Court of Appeal in Malawi has decided that the elections were not credible enough, free and fair for the people of Malawi. And there are a lot of irregularities that are there. And the same Electoral Commission, which is actually will be running the fresh presidential election, is the one that is also was also charged to run the previous election. So we feel that Malawians have lost trust in the Malawi Electoral Commission. We feel that the Malawians would actually reinstate the trust if only the Malawi Electoral Commission was changed to actually. So we feel there is need to change the Malawi Electoral Commission so that the people feel that they have a new electoral commission, and the Malawi Electoral Commission regains its trust from Malawians. So without this, we feel that we would have a lot of challenges, because the previous challenges were actually committed by the same members of Electoral Commission that we are entrusting the trust with today. So we feel that there's mistrust, and there's also a close relationship between the governing political party and the Malawi Electoral Commission. As you've seen from the judgments that are made, actually alluded to strong relationship and defense of the Malawi Electoral Commission that is now here to run the new presidential elections.
But the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission is due to retire in June. So possibly a new person will be chosen to lead the commission. What are your thoughts?
In that situation, as Malawians, our hands are tied up, but we need to move forward. And we don't have to compromise on this one. So my take would be, let us forge ahead, let us move ahead, just choose the new Malawi Electoral Commission, which is capable, and a commission that would run our elections without bringing in any deficiencies. We should choose capable people who can actually handle the elections without biasness, but with a forward-looking eye. So we need that. We need to bring that into our consideration. I believe in Malawi, we have many capable people who can easily handle the elections. It doesn't mean that we do not have people who cannot handle the elections, but those who are on the seat actually taking advantage of the jurisdiction that has been given, and they feel that they're the only capable people who can run the elections.
The HRDC and its supporters are calling for the resignation or firing of Dr. Justice Ansah, chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission. And others are saying same. The government said she's not breaking any law, so she should be maintained. What is your stance?
As the Catholic Commission for Justice and Peace in Karonga Diocese, we feel that she's not capable of running the next elections. She has shown that she's not capable even to run a single election. We feel that she should give others an opportunity to legally and perfectly run the elections. She should give a chance to others to land the election. This is because in the past she has actually, in the past she has shown that she's not capable of conducting any eligible elections. And this is evidenced by the court's ruling, that is Constitutional Court and Supreme Court of Appeal.
I mean, President Mutharika is constitutionally mandated to choose who the next chairperson of the Electoral Commission should be. What is your stance on that?
I feel that we observe, and this is a good thing that the president has the mandate by the establishment of the constitution, choose whoever will be the chairperson for Malawi Electoral Commission. However, we will observe the weakness that presidentialism has given him a lot of powers to choose whoever will run the elections and the whole electoral process. As much as we would love to have the process that is credible, participatory, inclusive and free, so that all Malawians are able to accept the process itself. As of now, we don't have that process. If anything, we would love to have a president who would choose the leader of Malawi Election Commission, who would be accepted by all Malawians and trusted by all Malawians, so that our electoral process is also credible and fair and inclusive for all Malawians.
Luis Nkata is the head of the Justice and Peace Department of the Catholic Mission for Justice and Peace. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, the people of Lesotho are remembering Chief Sekonyana Nehemiah Masaribane, the country's first prime minister. He served for only 62 days, from May 6, 1965 to July 7, 1965, representing the Basotho National Party, or BNP. Supporters say Masaribane was a consummate Democrat who advocated political tolerance, camaraderie and unity, which they say is lacking in the country's current democratic dispensation. They also contend that if his stance on peace and working together to resolve common issues are embraced, the country's political turmoil could be resolved. The Southern African Kingdom is often embroiled in political instability over sharp policy differences among the political elites. Thesele Masaribane is the Minister of Information and son of the former Prime Minister. He tells me that his father left a great legacy, which, if emulated, he said, will help resolve the country's political challenges.
He can be remembered by what you call political tolerance or political maturity in those early days of democracy in Lesotho, by winning elections as a deputy leader of a political party, but not going ahead without leaving his leader. So he did arrange the first free and fair elections for his leader to be in parliament.
Talking about tolerance, do you think modern-day Lesotho, the political class, has learned anything from the first prime minister about tolerance? Because Lesotho is known as one of the countries that is most unstable, politically speaking, in the Southern African Development Community region.
We are a small country which is surrounded by a huge economy and also with dynamic politics that we see in South Africa. And Lesotho, I agree with you that it is one country that has been said it is not politically stable. But remember, we are experiencing what I can say, second stage of trying to manage our democracy through coalition governments. It is our first time to experience challenges in coalition governments. Maybe first stage was that it is because of our electoral model. It is because we don't have political tolerance. We don't have political maturity. We need to look at our constitution. We are facing reforms. So my answer is that respect to leaders of that formed their own parties. It is still there, but the first time that I've met with, I've been in politics, is that there is lack of political tolerance in the country.
What do you think can be done currently that will be drawing inspiration from the first prime minister to learn about political tolerance to ensure the kingdom of Lesotho remains politically stable and not a troubled child, as some critics call it?
Well, there is a lot that has to be done as on the platform of political education. I think our history tells us that the first king of Basotho, which is Moshoeshoe, he's been in the whole world rated as one of the Democrats because of Moshoeshoe philosophy. And my father is a prime minister. He also comes from that family tree of Moshoeshoe, so that we can put our minds together as young people in politics to really understand the philosophy behind being called a Mosotho. I think we have lost track there, where we are trying to maybe copy other culture interests in politics from other societies. We are a country that can be able to learn from some of the examples that my father contributed in the history of democracy in the whole world by respecting his or his leader after his leader losing elections and saying, look, I've got my own leader. I'm the first prime minister, but let us do some re-election in one of the constituencies that was called a very safe constituency so that my party leader can be in parliament so that he can become a prime minister of Lesotho. So my point is that we need not to hide our history. We need to find any educational platform. It can be by documentaries, it can be by writing of books or platforms where the young Democrats in Lesotho can have an opportunity to learn some of those important gestures that our grand-grandfathers did to this country.
You were close to power and you are still close to power now in the current democratic dispensation in the Kingdom of Lesotho. What did you learn from your father that is informing your decisions at the moment in Lesotho?
What I learned from my father was that I should appreciate and respect people that voted me for the position by collective responsibility from my political party. As a leader of that political party at the moment, I should listen to everybody. And as a leader, I must make decisions. Decisions that can be popular or not popular to those who are supposed to adhere by those decisions. I should be a family man. He was a family man and a Christian. And also, one of the most important things is to not to be corrupt.
Tesele Masribani is the Minister of Information and son of Lesotho's first Prime Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. World Athletics, together with the International Athletics Foundation, IAAF, has launched a $500,000 fund to support professional athletes experiencing financial hardships due to the coronavirus pandemic. World Athletics President Sebastian Coe, who also chairs IAAF, said the fund would be used to assist athletes who have lost most of their income in the last few months due to the suspension of international competition. Coe will chair an expert multi-regional working group to assess the applications for assistance, which will be submitted through World Athletics' six area associations. He said it was important that the sport supported its athletes most in need during the current circumstances. In football, as plans begin to consider resumption of competitions across the world following the COVID-19 pandemic, the International Football Association Board has agreed to make a temporary amendment to the laws of the game after proposal from FIFA seeking to protect player welfare. In the temporary amendment, each team will be permitted to use a maximum of 5 substitutes. To reduce disruption to the match, each team will have a maximum of 3 opportunities to make substitutions during the game. Substitutions may also be made at halftime. If both teams make substitutions at the same time, this will count as one of the 3 opportunities for each team. Unused substitutions and opportunities are carried forward into extra time. And substitutions may also be made before the start of extra time and at halftime in the extra time. The change applies to competitions due to be completed within this calendar year. Meanwhile, on Friday, South Korea opened football's post-coronavirus era without fans, but with an unprecedented international TV audience. The Korean K-League is the first competition of any standing to come back to life, and a host of safety precautions have been imposed, with wild goal celebrations and even talking discouraged. Also, the German Bundesliga will resume on May 15th. The German league confirmed the date on Wednesday after Chancellor Angela Merkel and state leaders gave the green light to restart behind closed doors. German top flight becomes the first of Europe's 5 major leagues to return to the field. The English Premier League, Europe's richest league, aims to restart in June, but differences have emerged over plans to use neutral stadiums. And in boxing, the rivalry between real deal Evander Holyfield and Iron Mike Tyson seems to never have ended. 53-year-old Tyson wants to box again in charity matches, and now 57-year-old Holyfield has announced he will make a similar move. Holyfield, a former undisputed champion at cruiserweight and heavyweight, is raising money for United for Our Fight, a charity that helps learning and emotional development projects aimed at children whose schooling was disrupted by the coronavirus pandemic. Tyson, the youngest heavyweight world champion in history, is making his own return to the ring for charity. Holyfield claimed wins over Tyson in 1996 and 1997. Their 2 fights generated over $200 million in total. In the second encounter, Tyson beat the ear of his rival, prompting a disqualification. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
No cussing over, baby, come over, stay over. And I'll give anything, and I'll do anything. I'ma go down, go down, go down, go down. If you're down, I'm down, we are down, so go down. Now the way where you do me so, now the way you do me. See the way that you do what you do to me, girl, that makes me wanna be.
Situations come and go. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Another day, another goal.
Toto laini, laini, ana waka waka. Ah, wanga wape vidongi, nime baini, baini, wanatapa tapa. Minawe paka kiyama, tuombe uzima. Waroke kwa kuchutama, na wasimame wima. Kamwe watopata mwanya, habisi fitina. Wafike mabilinganya, situtoke dina. Nalegea, ukintazama yako macho, yako macho. Toto hodari,
hodari wa mapenzi,
jamani hodari,
hodari wa mapenzi,
kwa mchezo ya chumbani, hodari,
hodari wa mapenzi,
kutandani, hodari,
hodari wa mapenzi.
Katoto somo na kuwi chumbani kiranga kinaishaga komo kirumi nisakata makirikiri kuniwashaka kipiri funi haswa mikiri.
kunifiri unipanilewe kwasa kwasa ndani bingiri za kukata saga kachiri nani haswa unafikiri kama sio wewe nichezeshe kidabu sosi kwa manane yanga nikande kipanda usoto unikane kanga nipitishe bodala uko tukakutane kanga siye pini wa uputo wasijichanganye watapasuka nalegea ukintazama yako macho yako macho Toto hodari,
hodari wa mapenzi,
jamani hodari,
hodari wa mapenzi,
kunengua hodari,
hodari wa mapenzi,
kunilidua
hodari, hodari wa mapenzi.
Are you lying,
sir? Yes, sir. Wema sepetu hodari.
Hodari wa mapenzi,
uo ya hodari.
Hodari wa mapenzi,
mama kuki hodari.
Hodari wa mapenzi,
mbote hodari.
Hodari wa mapenzi,
jengiopa hodari.
Hodari wa mapenzi,
mama tifa hodari.
Hodari wa mapenzi,
uwez makan hodari.
تاني حب قلبي من جديد بعد غيبة جاني رح نداني خلى عمري كله عيد
الليالي رجعت لي تاني حب قلبي من جديد بعد غيبة جاني رح نداني خلى عمري كله عيد كنت فين
يا شاغل لي هوايا
كنت فين
يا اللي قلبك معايا
كنت فين
يا شاغل لي هوايا
كنت فين
يا اللي قلبك معايا ليالي ليالي ليالي
الليالي رجعت لي تاني حب قلبي من جديد بعد غيبة كاني رح نداني خلى عمري كله عين
يا غالي تغير لي حالي على شوقي ليك بصحى وبنام علمتي روحي تهواك يا روحي وتدوق معاك اجمل غرام
حبك يا غالي
غير
لي حالي
على شوقي ليك بصحى
tell me who made it possible?
Who made it possible? Who made it possible?
Only God made it possible.
God made it possible.
Girl, I wish say, I fit say, you too fine past my mama, but that is impossible. No. Thumbs up to your mama, cause she made it possible. Yeah. Girl, you too fine, my girl, I still believe say, I fit say, you too fine past my mama, but that is impossible. No.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, never use what you got by grace to disgrace others. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.